Welcome to Influential Visions. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. My name is Nathaniel Schooler, and I am your host today. Well, I'm very happy to be joined again by Nicholas Babin. And and I'm really excited. I shouldn't say that because my godfather tells me off for always saying that, right? But we're going to talk about innovation in technology, talking cars, robotic dogs, AI, 3D printing, and everything else, right? Because you've been involved with this sort of stuff from the ground up, right? Since 1996, yeah, when the first GPS system was created, right? And I'd love to hear more about that, Nicholas.
Yes, thanks, Nat. Yes, in 1996, I was managing director in the UK, so for European business of ETAC, the digital map company, which was owned by Sony. My first job with Sony, and we were using Ordnance Survey mapping, and we were improving the Ordnance Survey mapping with people going around the UK all year long, every day, discovering one-way streets, no right turn, no left turn, all these things. And we were adding that onto the mapping. And then we had a digital map that could be used with Sony's technology to get the first GPS system out. So at the beginning, because the GPS signal was being downgraded by the military for the war in Iraq, we had to use wheel sensors. So it was unbelievable. We had a technology called map matching, which would take the signal from the GPS and the wheel sensors and match it on the map. So we were about 100 meters, 150 meters off, but it was really unbelievable. I had people, I lived at the time in Wimbledon, and I had neighbors in my cul-de-sac come to my place and ask if they could have a tour in the talking car. It was just unreal. The first time you sit in that car and you hear, please take next right at the roundabout, please take the second exit, people were just like looking at you saying, what's going on here? And then the first time I used it for a long trip was to go from Wimbledon to Chichester for a wedding party. And so I had friends who were my age, you know, talking about new technology and all these things. And so I hadn't told them about the car. They had their maps on their lap, you know, saying, okay, you need to turn right. And then suddenly the car talked. And the car said, I can't say what they said because it's pretty vulgar. I won't say it on the show, but they were just all, well, you know what? Just listen to the car. And then I can't remember how long it took. It was about an hour and a half or something, or 2 hours. And he said, well, that's it. You've arrived at your destination. And they all looked like, man, can we have another tour of the car? And I said, no, that's all right. We're going to enjoy the party. And then we'll go back and we'll use the tool. So it's, again, you know, innovation, thinking what's the worst thing is that you get lost somewhere. You have no phone coverage, especially at the time, you know, mobile phones were just starting and all this. And having a car that would tell you where to go. When you think about it, this was the first ever GPS. Now, what would you do without GPS, right? So again, Sony was at the beginning of that technology. They sold ETAC in 2000 because they couldn't see the business take off. And just after they decided to do that, the business took off. And it was just, and today, you know, Waze on your phone bought by Google for billions, if I remember correctly. It's just the technology is absolutely superb. So that was the first experience back from 1996, and me being very popular with all my neighbors in Wimbledon cul-de-sac with people wanting to have a tour in that talking car.
Yeah, I remember having one of the first, you know, not like, obviously not as early as that, right? But I remember having like this GPS, and they were awful, like compared to what you have now, right? Like it's crazy what we have now. Like if you know, you can take an iPad, right? And you can be in an aeroplane and you can have your iPad tell you how far you are from the ground, right? Like obviously you have to set it, yeah? You have to set it. I forget how that actually works. My buddy, he's got loads of GPS systems, yeah, in his little airplanes, right? But it's quite bizarre, yeah. Like, but you still need to learn how to navigate using other methods before you actually can pass your license, apparently, right? So that's quite interesting. I find that quite interesting. So
same for boats. Today GPS works on boats. And same thing, you have to know in case your GPS system goes down in the middle of the Atlantic, you need to be able to calculate how to go from point A to point B on a boat. So same thing. But again, you know, if we hadn't started back in 96 with that system, and we wouldn't be where we are today. So we have to start with something that was not fantastic. I found the other day in my junk, if I could say, the system that we used to sell to consumers. It was called StreetMate. SkyMap in the US, StreetMate in the UK and in Europe. And it was a CD-ROM working on any laptop with a PCMCIA card. I don't know if you remember those big cards called PCMCIA that you used to plug in into your laptop. Mm-hmm. And the PCMCIA card was linked to a GPS system that you would put on the dashboard of the car. And so with your laptop, that was the first GPS system working, you know, without being embedded into the car. And that one was a huge success. We use obviously the Sony network for that and sold it to all the major couriers and stuff. And it was about £150 at the time, so not that expensive. And because it was so innovative, people were just crazy about it. And we had fantastic mapping because Ordnance Survey mapping at the time, the reason I'm saying at the time is because today I don't know if it's still the best, but it was absolutely fantastic. And what we had added on top of it made it really robust and fun system to use. And that's what innovation is all about. It's like, you know, starting somewhere, and then today you look at it and you think, my boy was born in 1996. He's only seen you know, GPS systems in cars. It's like he doesn't even know what the map looks like, you know, paper map. I'm thinking he's 24 years of age, and for him it's just natural. You go into a car and you say where you're going and you just follow the voice. But it's not what you and I have known before.
No, it's crazy, right? Like I just remember like having my first car, like I had to read a map. Yeah, you know,
that's it.
Yeah, so what about these robotic dogs then that you were talking about?
Yeah, so that was the after I was managing director of that division of Sony, I became managing director of Sony Entertainment Robot Europe, SCRE, based in London. And SCRE was sold AIBO dogs. So AIBO stand for Artificial Intelligence Bot, no, BO for robot. It was the first AI-based robot that we sold in shops. So again, all the various shops that in the UK and Europe, we sold it in a lot of countries, Russia, France, UK, Germany, Spain. And so AIBO also in Japanese means companion. So it was really designed by Sony to make elderly people, especially in Japan, be able to have a companion with them and also be able to do things for them. So AIBO would understand some words, about 50 words, which was pretty good at the time. The robotic work with Sony started back in 1993. The first product launch was 1999, which I believe is still the fastest selling electronic product, and it's on the Guinness Book of Records. In 20 minutes, I think we sold about over 200,000. I don't remember exactly the numbers, but it was something absolutely fantastic. And when AIBO came out in 1999, I remember, again, neighbors wanted to have, because I had one at home. I remember schools for my kids saying, can we have a demo of the dog?
Of course.
And it was unbelievable. There's a joke about it that my wife belonged to the American group of women in Surrey. And one day she was making a presentation and people say, what does your husband do? And said, he sells dogs. I had to tell her, say, can you just precise exactly what kind of dogs I sell? Because it's quite interesting to know that it's like actually AI-based dogs. And those robots, you know, you had Wi-Fi system in the robot, so you could control the robot from your PC and see what he would see, hear what he would hear. So it's, you know, of course, for great pranks amongst
friends. Oh, yeah.
But also, it could be autonomous, and the robot could really be 24/7 in your house, look and do a room mapping of what the room would look like, and realize where the charger would be. And so when the battery would go down, and I still have some, I have four at home, and they still work for that. It's just unbelievable. As soon as he realizes that the battery goes down, he goes towards the battery, turns around, back up into the battery charger, and charges itself. And as soon as it's done, he goes back out and lives his own life. And that innovation was just unbelievable, because today, everything that AIBO did has helped, you know, big companies to improve on walking, because AIBO was four-legged, and also we had Curio, which was a two-legged. So we had worked on balance. We had worked on mechatronics, which is the way robots would evolve. So trying to imitate as much as possible a real dog.
Yep.
So how the real dog would walk. Also, we had face recognition. We had done face recognition for a family cluster, so up to five people. So AIBO would know who's the master, who's
wow.
the one, and all these things. We're talking about 99, 2000 at the time. It was just...
Wow.
Yeah, it was. And today, face recognition, you know, people are saying, wow, this is unbelievable, face recognition. Well, it exists for a long time ago.
Of course.
AIBO would recognize you. AIBO would take pictures. You know, you just say, take a picture, and AIBO will sit down, and you'll be here at 10, 9, 8.
Oh, wow. You see that... But so where has that evolved to now? Like do they have a product that does that, or are there multiple? Because I haven't really investigated this part of innovation, if I'm honest. Like,
yeah. I know, because the product was expensive. It was roughly around 2,000 euros. And there were some marketing mistakes made in the US, especially because the US thought they would sell it as a toy, which was absolutely not a toy. And even Americans did not spend 2,000 euros for a toy. Whereas in Europe, I really focused on selling it as an entertainment AI tool. So I put forward the AI angle. And so we actually, Europe was more successful than anywhere else in the world selling the product, because we also managed to have some point of sales in shops. That's actually also another very interesting story. When I first came to a big Sony Centers at the time, and I showed them the product, they looked at me with this very white face, and I said, "What's wrong? You know, like, why are you looking at me like this?" Said, "Well, we're not used to selling products that move. You know, we sell televisions, we sell refrigerators, we sell, but how are we going to do it with a robot that actually moves around the shop?" So I had to. That's what, you know, it's so disruptive, because of course the salespeople on the floor, they had no idea how to do it, and they were worried that, you know, AIBO would walk out of the shop. Of course he could potentially. So I had
of course.
So I made those big point of sale that were at human height with a big globe on it. So it was this table that was about 1.80 meters or 1.70 meters. And we had a big, like a desk where AIBO could walk around, but pretty large. And on top of it, we put a plastic dome with a hole in it, so AIBO would listen to commands, because, as I said, he could understand about 50 words. And so people, you know, and it was locked, so people could not take AIBO and run, basically, because as like any dog, basically, you can just steal it. So we had to invent this, and... And at the end, it was great, because AIBO would welcome everyone in the shop, because AIBO could be autonomous, but also you could program AIBO. And we had memory sticks at the time that you could program from your PC. And so today, Sony, in 2005, when Sony had these financial problems, they decided to stop that. To me, that was a mistake, because it was such an image-building product.
Yeah.
They decided to restart the business back in 2018 at the CES in Las Vegas. They showed a new AIBO, which, you know, it's. I don't think that they're really using it for image building. But today, what has, you know, all the engineers that have worked on AIBO, which were really the first time, they have moved on to other companies. And every technology, every piece of technology that you've seen in AIBO is being now, you know, developed at Boston Robotics, because Boston Robotics, they are fantastic at all the mechatronics work, because they managed, you know, they can jump, they can rebound, they can run, they can go on any type of terrains. And so everything that we had to invent at Sony, and that has been the story of Sony, because everything that Sony invented, then Sony gave it up because they thought, well, you know, maybe it's not great business. And then it's been taken over by others and then a huge success. And you would talk about, you know, VHS, we talk about Walkman, inventor of Walkman back in 1979. First Walkman invented by Sony. I don't know if you remember, it was the cassettes, you know, the old ones. Today, you know, it's in your phone pretty much, but iPod was based on Walkman. We invented the battery, the lithium ion battery that would make the Walkman last longer. And today, again, all over, but Sony has given up and finished with Walkman. So you see, it's very interesting. AIBO has brought on huge business around AI and around robotics. But again, Sony today is not seen as the forefront as they used to be about, we stopped 2005. So yeah, until 2005, Sony was just, anytime you would bring, you talk about AIBO, I had people come to demos of AIBO and be like, I remember in Manchester, we had the Trafford Shopping Center, one of the largest one in the UK. And I would bring AIBOs and people would just come, and it was like, we had to ask security to help us to get people out because they were just fascinated by robots. Yeah. I even had one guy at the Trafford Shopping Center attack an AIBO and ripped his head off.
Wow.
He said, yeah, I don't want robots to replace me. You know, so we always had engagement, whether good, whether bad, but that product was just absolutely unbelievable. I did the first board meeting on September 11th, 2001, famous day. We were in Stockholm, where Sony wanted to impress Ericsson. That was the first board meeting of Sony and Ericsson. You probably remember that joint venture. And the only product that Sony showed to Ericsson was AIBO. I was invited with, you know, I made a joke during the demo. I said, well, I have my boss here, my boss's boss, my boss's 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 boss in the room. So basically, the chairman of Sony World was in the room. You know, it was just like, and the only product they showed was AIBO, again, because it was so advanced.
Yeah.
So Sony was, for that, a fantastic company that always trying to innovate, always trying to bring forward technologies that other companies would not dare to do or didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, that was a very long, but I get passionate anytime I talk about AIBO.
That's super interesting. So now we've moved beyond that, right? And we are, let me see. We're in a place now where we don't quite know what's going to look like once we move beyond where we're at right now, right? And you know, there's a lot we could sort of talk about from there, right? But like the two things that I think are super interesting, and I know you share that enthusiasm, right, are obviously the AI and the 3D printing, right? And you know, I mean, I think certainly with the robotic dog and the 3D printing, a lot of innovation kind of came from MIT, didn't it, to create that. I mean, they created like the 3D printer, didn't they, in the early days?
Yeah.
And now, you know, you can print all sorts of things. You can print clay. You can print buildings. So, what do you think about 3D printing? Yeah.
I think it's a fantastic technology. I think it's an affordable technology. I can see today with COVID fights, at least the fight against COVID, it is the role 3D printing is playing is just enormous, tremendous, as somebody would say, where you can build masks very quickly in a cheap way again. You see a lot of people doing it from their home and delivering them to hospitals. So it's again, I've seen in China, houses being built in like less than a week with 3D printing. I think 3D printing is just superb. On top of it, the way it has been marketed has been fantastic because it's very collaborative. You can look in your town where you are, where there's a 3D printer, and you know, do your own work at home and just send it there and pay just for as you go, pretty much.
Oh, that's wonderful. I didn't know you could do that. I was talking to a chap the other day that actually has done a lot of innovation for like Dyson and you know, lots and lots of big brands like the BBC. He did a lot of work on really micro projects with 3D printers, because what he was saying was, you know, you can get something to a certain point, but then you need to customize it.
Yeah.
So for example, like I think he worked on this adaptation to someone's prosthetic limb, for example. Yeah, it didn't quite like fit. So So the guy was like, "Can you make this for me? I need something extra that's gonna make this more comfortable." Yeah. So there's a kind of really big opportunity there, I think, certainly within 3D printing, to manufacture locally a lot more items. But then obviously you've got the mass manufacturing of things, like with you know, lots of different factories that they can't actually do that. It's not possible for them. So I don't know. So it's kind of like they're creating a big product en masse, yeah?
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, okay. So I need one of these little things that, you know, kind of goes on the edge kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you've seen that there's this big sports brand that had invented years ago a mask where you fit the mask and it's very tight, so it works great. And you have the tube going from there. So you breathe in the mask, like, you know, normally you have the mask in your the tube in your mouth, and and the mask only covers your eyes. This time they had invented this mask, and somebody realized that with just a small adapter on top of the mask, this mask could be fitted to a respirator.
Wow.
So they've built, and it was like a very simple T-like piece of plastic that could be printed out of a 3D printer. And so now in France, and I believe it's also in the UK, hospitals are using this mask because that company has offered for free, like hundreds of thousands of masks. The masks are not available anywhere on the planet now to be sold. Because they've decided to give them to hospitals that were lacking respirators. And it's just like a 3D printer taking, I believe, like 2 hours just to print that little joint, piece of plastic, and that they can fit on top of the mask and then fits into the machine. It's just that 3D printing thing is really technology, sorry, nothing. Technology is just absolutely superb, can do anything pretty much. Toys for your kids, you know, you always have a limb missing, you always have a hand missing, whatever, it can reprint that. I remember exactly.
Yeah, but the problem is, I've got a 3D hand here that my buddy made me. And it did have a middle finger, and I dropped it on the floor. Yeah. And look, like the middle finger, it fell off. Yeah. So I actually spoke to this chap the other day, and he spent 3 years working on adhesives. So he knows. So I said, "What do I use?" He said, "What type of 3D printed method did you use?" Yeah. And I asked my friend, he said, "It's this." So I was like, "Okay." He said, "You just need a tiny little piece of super glue to fix it." Yeah. But I think my buddy's bored. I think he's going to make me like a peace sign or something. Yeah.
Yeah. That's better.
Yeah. I think I need a peace sign, but you know, it's incredible that we've come from this place where, you know, these things were so expensive, to now having a 3D printer that you can buy for like £300. Yeah.
Or you can share, as I mentioned.
Or you can share, like you said, and at even less than 300. But also you can actually go online, and you can go to lots of libraries of items, and you can go and you can adapt those libraries, which I thought was super interesting. I still haven't got the skills quite yet. My buddy Eric, he's like right into this stuff. Like he made a pedal for his aeroplane. Yeah. So, you know, he makes really practical things. You know, well, like my 3D hand, obviously. But it's super interesting because there are other methods of 3D printing as well, right? Like there's this sort of flash 3D printing, isn't there? Which is like, it's a liquid that has, I don't quite know how that works. Do you know much about that one? Or
no, I don't. I've read about it. I've not seen it. Whereas the other type of 3D printing, I've seen it work.
But
I know it's a liquid that dries very quickly and is sent to a receptacle that in a very fast way. I mean, it's the technology seems fantastic, but frankly, I've not studied that too much.
I think it's actually a laser that that hits the specific thing. Okay. I'm not quite sure how it works, but I think, you know, you can look on YouTube all of these kind of things if you want to go into the details.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because today it's just, when you talk about innovation, it's just
crazy.
We mentioned AI before, we mentioned 3D printing, even in terms of digital technology, you know, blockchain is also a great innovation for the technology and to help with money laundering, avoiding money laundering, for example, avoiding problems with insurance companies. I mean, it's just... the world we live in now is just absolutely unbelievable, and it's perfect timing, if I could say that, because when you look at the problems that COVID has started, if we didn't have innovation, imagine like about 30 or 40 years ago, we would have COVID-19. We would have been stuck at home with no way of accessing anything. Today, you're stuck at home, but you can work from home. You can see your bodies. We've started to do aperitif, as we say in French, online, you know, with friends and everything. You say cheers and you have a drink and you say jokes. I know it's not the same as being in a pub and enjoying pub life. But, you know, again, 40 years ago, no way you would have done this. 40 years ago would have been a disaster. You know, people felt like terrible about it. Whereas today, at least we're enjoying technology. And also technologies at the service of doctors and everything, as we mentioned about 3D printing, but AI also is making calculation right now to find the right, what the DNA of the virus is. Normally this takes years or months at least for doctors to find that, but with the power of AI and the fact that it goes much faster and it also takes in consideration much more data than anything than your brain would be capable, then this is how we're going to see a vaccine much faster, and this is how we understand the virus much better. So it's you know, it's not only about helping us to have a better life, to calculate how to go from A to Z, but it's also about us improving our health and making sure that at least we understand what's going on around us.
Yeah.
So this innovation, I mean, as I mentioned to everybody, because people are saying, you know, about robotics, I hear it all. They're going to replace us, AI, you're going to lose your privacy. You've done some fantastic podcast about data privacy.
Thank you.
Honestly, I've learned a lot about that.
Well, you helped me a lot with that. It was very useful what we talked about the other week on that one, you know, really useful.
But my point about that is that, yes, people can be scared about innovation, but at the end of the day, if it's done properly, and if you think about, you know, the repercussions of innovation well in advance, then you can use it to your benefit. Of course, and I'm not being naive when I say that, you know, some bad people are going to use innovation and new technologies to make it better for them. But what's really important is to know that the train has left the station, right? Try to stop it now. Yeah, good luck. So the thing is, be pragmatic about it. Try to find the good out of innovation and make it work for you or for the benefit of humanity.
Very much so. And then that leads into the last topic for today, which I think's, you know, so important, is the ethics of AI, right? And actually the ethics of business fits into that as well, right? So it's kind of like, okay, so we need to eliminate the bias, because there's a big thing with AI of like bias, yeah? Because the people who are programming it are creating an automatic bias, right? In many cases, yeah? So obviously we need to kind of think about, that's something that needs some further research. Everything that's being launched, it looks like is being built within someone else's trusted environment. Like a lot of this stuff is being built on you know, Oracle Cloud, IBM Cloud, AWS, yeah. Like all the big players have got their own AI modules, right? Would you call it a module?
Algorithm.
That's in a container, right? Like a Kubernetes or whatever, yeah. And those. So, how do you know much about like how that kind of works, or are we?
Yeah, ethics has been something that we worked with Sony from the beginning, because obviously coming out with robots, we had to think about it. So we had the different laws that that were invented back in the 50s. That we wanted to implement. But ethic, and as you mentioned about bias, is something very important with AI, because AI has been programmed by men, right? So men are biased. Even if you try to be as neutral as possible, you always have a bias. And so basically the code that you're going to create, it's going to reflect the biased angle that you're putting in. So that's why it's really important to have some governance around AI and ensure that, you know, that there's things that you can do, things you can't do, but always leaving man in charge. When I talk about AI, one very important point I always mention is human augmented. It's not human replacement, and it's not about, you know, forcing human doing things that he shouldn't be doing. It's having human always in charge. And AI is there to help us to be better, because we will be able to consider much more around a specific environment. So, you know, more data, speed of data, more analysis, more anything basically that you can find into an algorithm is going to make a huge impact on how you can manage that ethic better. It's important. And more than important, it's you have to make it happen that anytime you have an AI strategy, and I know these big companies do, and I'm not saying they don't. Important that you have an ethic committee that looks at all the potential forecasts or the potential issues that could come from AI. So, you know, AI is a fantastic technology, and again, the train has left the station. You know, you can't go back on it. It started back in the 50s again. So it's not a new technology, but it's just today, because we have speed, we have cloud, we have data, we have data scientists, we have, you know, all this new world around data. That's why today it's becoming so important. But again, you know, when we launched IGO back in 1999, it was based on AI. So we started to have data. We could see if somebody was living alone. I even saw some technology in the Sony laboratories where we had TV with AI. So the TV will see you come back at 1 o'clock in the morning with somebody of a different sex or same sex, absolutely no issue there. But somebody that, you know, the TV would not recognize. So the TV would start thinking, oh, maybe it's a date. So I'm going to turn myself on with some nice classical music to make it more romantic. I've seen that in the labs. I've seen radios do that. I've seen TVs do that. And the TV also would go look at where the people would be sitting. So they're sitting on the sofa. Okay, great. So I'm moving myself in front of the sofa to make sure that at least I'm absolutely straight in the middle or in front of them. Oh, and now they're laying down. So I'm going to tilt myself to make sure that at least they can have a better experience about the picture.
Wonderful. You know,
these type of things. But when you think about it, yeah, it's wonderful because the user experience is wonderful. But behind that, that data could be, you know, stored. For example, this person is not his wife, right? So this data could be used against the person saying he's cheating, right? And if the data is in the hands of the wrong person, then of course the wife could be aware of that, or family could be aware of that, and then it could lead to a lot of trouble.
Blackmail. All sorts of things. I mean, yeah. I mean, we're going to talk a lot more about things like that fairly soon, because it's very relevant to the influencer marketing company that I'm a principal consultant for, and you work with us from time to time, you know. And all of this data, the personality profiling, the buying mindset people have, the content relevance, the location of the content, the social sharing tools and automations, and, you know, all of these things are super important, and they all come down to the data in the first place, right? So yeah, we're going to have a really, really interesting conversation around that, but we've got to prep. I want to create an amazing piece of content there. And that's super interesting talking about all this, Nicholas. Absolutely super. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nat.
Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections too. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thank you.